But this next weekend, we'll all be at the farm, all of you who can come. So anybody have anything on your mind? You know, I want to say a little bit more about this meditation. There's another thing I talked about it, maybe not that much, maybe a few times. You know, every experience that you have, whether it's an experience that's generated through your sense perception, like in the world that you perceive through your five sense organs, which includes the physical body. The physical body is also is known to you through your sensory perception. If you were to remove each sense organ one by one, you would lose the experience of the physical body. So the whole physical world is available to you through your sense perception, which gives you a vritti, a thought modification. So really, your experience is of a thought modification. Right? It's a vritti. Everybody see that? Every thought that you have, whether it be what it's an emotion, is a vritti, thought modification, or a perception is a thought modification, a memory is a thought modification. Your imagination is a thought modification, your dreams are thought modifications, they're all vrittis, right? So that is your experience. In terms of any, all objectifiable experience is going to be in the form of a vritti, a thought modification. So that's important to move on. If that's clear, when you have a thought modification, which is an imagination, for instance, like say I ask you to have a daydream or imagine walking through the park or imagine an ocean scene or imagine a scene in the city, any type of imaginal scene, right? When you're having that imagination, say I'm asking you to have an imagination, and then as part of the meditation or this guided meditation, as you're having this imagination, I say, you know, that is your body, and that is your sidewalk, that is your skyscraper, that is your sun, that is your sky. All of those things, you know, are you, because your imagination. Or you could say, that is my sun, that is my sky, that is my body, that is my thought, that is my friend. All of those belong to you because the entire imagination is yours. And so I don't think that's a problem to relate to it. It's just to say it very simply, if you have an imagination or a daydream, or dream for that matter, if we analyze it, you could say that whole dream exists in me. I am the self of those, everything in that dream, or everything in that imagination is myself. Right? In truth, it's myself. So the me, my sense of me, is spread equally throughout the entire imagination, the sun and the clouds and the sky and the trees and the people, everything equal, and whoever I'm identified with in the imagination, everything equally enjoys me. Okay? Now I have to remember that the imagination is a vritti. It's a vritti. It's a thought modification. But in that type of thought modification, there is no problem recognizing that I am the self of the entire thought modification. Right? There's no problem. But my experience of this world through my sensory perception is also a thought modification. And so it is exactly the same in terms of my pervasiveness to the equally pervading the imaginal thought modification, or the thought modification born of my sensory perception, which then includes the body. You see what I mean? So what I'm saying is, no matter what the thought modification is, I am the self of that entire thought modification. It's very clear when it's an imagination or when it's a dream or something like that. But when the thought modification includes my body, then that subject-object identification kicks in with great intensity. It's much harder if I'm just sitting, being aware of my body. Say we're sitting in meditation and we're being, I'm aware of my experiences, I'm aware of my physical body, I'm aware of my breath. It's much harder for me to put those experiences on the same level as my experience of the sun and the sky and everything else that is also known to me only through a vritti. Why is that? Why that dehatma buddhi, that identification of the atma with the body, is so strong, even though it's an objectifiable experience? I wouldn't say if I have a thought modification of the trees in the park, etc., the trees in a park, I don't feel covered. My presence is not covered by those experiences. I don't even think about it, actually. I would feel like there's something wrong with me. Think about it. But the viveka between my own presence and whatever I'm experiencing external to the body, there's no sense of being covered, you know, by that experience. I am me. And the experience, the perception, is the perception. It's very clear, right? There is no difference at all between the I am me and my perception of the body. I know that's immediately harder. Nevertheless, there is no difference. There's no difference. Yourself is not touched or covered by an internal experience or by an external experience. There is this dehatma buddhi, which means I take myself to be that, right? I take my being, the atma, to be the deha, to be the body. That's a type of vritti, that's a conclusion. But that conclusion is not creating a reality. That what you think is happening is not happening. You know, there is no covering of yourself by the experience, whether it be a thought or an emotion or the physical body. There is no covering at all. There's no more covering between my being and the body, or my being and the tree at all. Zero. So the problem is not an actual covering or changing of my nature. The problem is on the part of the mind. It's on the part of the self, because the self is not doing anything. It's a problem on the part of the mind that has an avivēka, a lack of discrimination between itself as objectified and the consciousness, the conscious being, the me, which is the very being in which that objectification takes place. That's the thing. It's an avivēka between what we call the upādhi, the conditioning adjunct, and me. It's a lack of vivēka. It's not, there's nothing really happening there to make any kind of covering in any real sense at all. There's no more covering or merging than there would be between my vritti of the tree and myself. The vritti of the tree and myself, or the vritti of my body and myself. There's not that the vritti of, between my body and myself, somehow there's some merger taking place. There's no merger taking place. Nothing is happening. Right? That's why it's just a matter of recognition of how things actually are. The mind is the one that has to wake up. We can explain why the mind has that, is suffering from that aviveka, from that lack of discrimination. Because wherever the mind is, the self is. If the mind pervades the body through the sukshma sharira, then the body is as though enjoying consciousness from its own standpoint. Only from its own standpoint. And so, from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, there's an aviveka, there's a lack of discrimination, until somebody points it out, you know. The thing I'm trying to say here is that the aviveka, the lack of discrimination, is only a lack of discrimination. There is no reality in terms of any type of merger. You know, that's, again, we have to do this, the Brahma Sutra, Adhyasa Bhasha, where Shankara talks about this so clearly. The difference is, he'll say, the difference is like night and day. You don't mistake one for the other. There's no possibility of the one being the other. And that's our situation here. There's no possibility of me being tainted or touched or covered or afflicted in any way by objectifiable experiences. Nothing is happening to me ever in any way at all. No. But this is happening. So Shankara says, this is happening. What a wonder. How is it even possible? And then once that viveka takes place on the part of the mind, that discrimination takes place, once a mirror, in a sense, is held up, and you see, then you yourself say, how could that ever happen? How could, it's not even possible. How could that happen? Because nothing is touching me or hurting me or happening to me in any way. That's why there's such tremendous freedom. Once you see it, there's such tremendous freedom, because all of these things are happening, you know. All thoughts are happening, all feelings are happening, all relationships are happening, all things are happening in the world, and nothing is happening. Both are true, you know, from the standpoint of the Maya, both, so many things are happening from the standpoint of me. Nothing is happening. In fact, we've done some meditations on this. You say, I am free of time. I have no future. I have no future. I have no past. I am actually the present. But present is a relational word to past and future. So then I have to say, I am the presence. I am the very presence in which past, present, and future take place. But even that's not correct, because the future is imaginal. You don't experience the future. When you're experiencing the future, it's in the present. And you don't experience the past. You experience a memory of the past in the present. But you're never not in the present. But that's not even fair to say for yourself, because for yourself there is no past and there is no future. Memory is objectifiable. Imagination is objectifiable. Right? So there's no future for you and there is no past. So what does that mean when you're working for a better future? Or you're trying to recover from the past? You just have to be clear on your orders of reality. There's nothing wrong with working for a better future. You just have to know who's working for it and what the order of reality is. Because you're not going to become better. You know, and you're not going to become worse either. That's a huge thing. You can make things better, like you can lose weight or gain weight, become more healthy or gain more money and all of these type of things. You can do all of those type of things, but you are not becoming richer. You are not becoming thinner. You're not becoming more healthy. You simply are. You're free of all of that. And that doesn't negate doing all of those things. You just have to remember and recognize the order of reality that those things enjoy. And it's fine to do those things, but don't think that it's not your being, it's not being improved or hurt in any way. That's the thing. And there's a tremendous relief in that. Tremendous freedom in it. And then when you start to analyze the nature of these different levels of reality, you know, that's what we mean. It all becomes mithya. It's all maya. What does that mean really for me to say that all of this creation is maya, that it's mithya? What it means in another way of saying it, because sometimes when people use the word maya, they equate it with illusion, or it's just an illusion, or mithya, it's not real. That's not the attitude, right attitude for these words. Maya means that it has no being apart from me. The whole infinite creation is my being. It enjoys my being, and at the same time, it's being mithya, it doesn't bring about any change to me. So if you say this whole creation has no being apart from me, you can say this whole creation that we call maya is my expression. It's my expression. That's what we mean by Ishwara. The whole creation is Ishwara. This whole infinite creation is Ishwara. And whose self is Ishwara? Right? The self, myself, the self that is free from time, the self that is, you know, not subject to any type of change, is that self from whom the entire creation comes without bringing about any change to yourself. All of your experiences like that. You have so many experiences, so many different levels, different types of experiences. None of them bring about any change to yourself. And the whole creation is the same way. The whole infinite creation is an expression, a limitless expression of your being, and none of it brings about any change at all to yourself. That's what we mean by maya. It brings about, the entire creation brings about no change at all to your being. And your body, mind, sense organs is a part of that infinite expression. So your body, mind, sense organs is a part of the infinite expression of yourself. So in your relationship with Ishwara, the body, that as long as you have this body, mind, sense organs, that body that you're identified with, your mind is identified with as yourself, that body, mind, sense organs, is part of this infinite expression and belongs to this infinite expression. So your body, mind, sense organs, your life, your prarabdha karma, belongs to Ishwara. And Ishwara is the infinite expression of you. That's the Advaita. And just like none in this prarabdha karma, the whole series of experiences that you have don't bring about any change or don't touch your being in any way, the whole infinite creation is like that. The whole infinite creation doesn't touch your being, the conscious being, the me, in any way at all. But it is an infinite expression of conscious being, of me. So the whole creation is me. That's why you can say This is my sun. This is my sky. These are my trees. This is my forest. This is my atom bomb. There's nothing that's not me. In terms of this infinite expression, it's both me and not me, because it's an infinite expression of me, and at the same time, I don't do anything. So I'm free of it, but it's not free of me. That's the whole satyam mitya. So there can be there's a lot of words. I'm just rattling off a lot of words, but these words have to land. You have to see it in your life, in your day-to-day life. Anybody there? Nella and I are here, and Lucky. Edward's at home, but he couldn't get online, unfortunately. Okay, Hal, I'm just looking at your question. Let me look at these. Let me go back. Hang on. Okay. There seems to be some fear that when all experience, including body and mind experience, is equally a vritti distinct from me, then the basis for discrimination between vrittis have an objective srishti basis, and those that are purely subjective is threatened. Why is this? How to deal with this? I think there must be some confusion here. Some kind of, yeah, confusion with solipsism. Yeah. Let me take it line by line. Yeah, Hal, that might have been, there might be a confusion there with solipsism. Because of the way I was talking about this, what I was trying to do is to show that whether the vritti is subjective, like a subjective vritti would be like your imagination, for instance, or just thought flow, just something subjective that is not shared by other people. That vritti, when it's a subjective vritti, that is something which you can easily, even if you're having a vritti of like a scene in which you with your friends are walking through some sort of a daydream type vritti, it's still subjective. But you don't have any problem with recognizing you as being pervasive, the me as being pervasive to that vritti, and being the self of everything in the vritti. Right? So that I was using as an example, and then you would probably say, no, that's true. If I have a thought or imagination, I see the whole thing as coming from me, being sustained by me, resolving into me. I experience the vritti as I'm the Ishwara of that vritti, and I am the self of the whole vritti. So it's a subjective vritti. I don't have any problem. Now we go over to an objective vritti where it's still a vritti. The vritti quality of the vritti, the sattva, the nature of the vritti, the material of the vritti is exactly the same. Consciousness illumining the whole vritti, exactly the same. The difference is that one is objective, it's Ishwar Srishti, means the contents of the vritti are Ishwar Srishti, right? In the other vritti, the contents are subjective, Jiva Srishti. However, whether it's an objective vritti, means the contents are objective, Ishwara not created by me, subjective are created by me. Nevertheless, experientially, both are vrittis. One is a vritti gained through sense perception, the other is a vritti just gained through imaginal faculties, but both are vrittis. And both vrittis, whether objective or subjective, are illumined by one conscious being, me. That's exactly the same. It's not negating that there's a Jiva Srishti and Ishwara Srishti. That's accepted completely. But I'm talking about the relationship between the consciousness and the vritti. The relationship between consciousness and the vritti is the same and the material sattva of the vritti is the same. So why is it that when the self is the same, conscious being is the same, the pervasion of me to the vritti is the same, nevertheless, the objectification of everything within the vritti is the same. Nevertheless, in one, the object, in the subjective, I have no ahankara relationship with anything in that vritti, which again is just a thought, right? But in the objective, there's an ahankara that comes in that is so strong that it stops me. Ahankara, remember, is born of ajnanam. It's ignorance, self-ignorance. That ahankara is so strong that it stops me from recognizing that I am both free from the vritti, and I'm free from the vritti, I'm free from everything in the vritti, and I am the being of everything in the vritti. Right? There's no... One is easy for me to recognize, the other is very difficult for me to recognize because of this ahankara. But the solipsism, I think just because I didn't, it would have been better, and then when I was talking about it, if I would have used Jiva Srishti and Ishwar Srishti, and then shown that both of those, the Jiva Srishti is what I'm experiencing, and Jiva Srishti is a vritti, what I'm experiencing in Ishwar Srishti is a vritti. And the relationship of myself to either vritti is the same. And the material of the vritti is the same. You get it? So I just think it's very, very powerful, because if you can work with your... To understand this is really powerful, because if you can work with your imagination, like imagine yourself walking in a field or whatever, you can recognize, it's easy to differentiate your own, the freedom of your own presence in that vritti, and then do a Jiva Srishti, an Ishwara Srishti vritti, so something that's given to you through sense perception, and then do the same thing. Can you see that your being is pervasive and changeless in the whole, in that whole perception that you're having? Because it is exactly the same, even though in terms of teaching, we have to go into Ishwara Srishti and negate it, showing that it has no being apart from the self and all of that. I accept all of that. I'm just trying to show the power of the ahankara when that ahankara is there, not there, you don't have any problem. It's kind of like the difference between experiencing, and I was going to say that's not quite right, but I was going to say, you know, like if you're watching a film, the ahankara isn't there in the same way that when you're experiencing the world, you know. But that's not a very good example. That type of thing that I'm talking about there is something to kind of work with on your own. Like when you're right now at this moment, just noticing the difference. The ahankara, it is the dehatma buddhi. The dehatma buddhi means the conviction. Buddhi is the conviction that the self is the deha. Deha means body, but the body can stand for the subtle body also. And so the ahankara is anything that the eye can land on. Like I can say, and we call that an upadhi. So I am my body, or I am a woman, or I am a man, or I am fat, or tall, or old, or young. Whatever adjectives can go along with the body, you can identify that as yourself. That's the ahankara. Or it's like you're creating an I for yourself, where the I isn't fat, or tall, or man, or woman, or anything. Those are qualities of the body. Or I am happy, or I am sad. Those are qualities of the mind, but I say, I am that. Or I say my mind, so the word I and my. Wherever you can put I, unless it's landing on yourself, that's an ahankara. For ajnani, the ahankara is mitya. because we don't walk around saying, oh, the body is going to walk to the down to the river now, and the stomach is feeling hungry, and you know, we don't talk like that. We know what we're saying, right? If I say I'm going to the river, I don't think Atma just grew some legs. And when I say I, the I resolves into me, into the self. I think that's also kind of a fun little exercise, like just to say the word I and have it resolve into you. You know, just the word I. Or me, have it resolve. When you use that word, have it resolve into your being, not into the upadhi. Because that certainly doesn't, for an ajnani, that's not what's going to happen. When you say the word I, it resolves into the body, mind, sense organ complex. You know? And that's its reality, because there's no viveka. Questions? You don't have to. Right?
I don't know if it's exactly a question. I don't know how to form it, but I don't know if it's relevant. I was just thinking about the Vritti's, you know, saying consensual reality, the experience of that is Vritti, just like an imagination. But, doesn't, I don't think this is really a Vedanta question about what's really out there, you know. I mean, I think that's a different topic.
I'll talk about it just a little bit. Okay. So Miller was just asking a question, like, say in the shared reality, we call it Vyavaharika, shared empirical reality that is not created by me, but I find myself in it. Like, I didn't create my body. Like, if I imagine my body, then that's my jiva srishti. And so then the question is, what is really out there? What is this physical reality that is Ishwara srishti? What is it made out of, you know? And so I'm sure that the thing is that there are many different models. There are scientific models. There are so many different models that are trying to define this, the substance of this reality that we experience, right? And so even with the Advaita Vedanta, with the Panchikaranam and all of that, looking at just the five elements and becoming fivefold and all of that. And the good thing about that Panchikaranam, or the way that Maya projects, that's really interesting in the Vedanta, is that it includes not only the perceived world, but it includes the experience of subject and object. That's why that is important. But the Indian projection of the creation is important because it includes also the energy and it includes the subject-object relationship. So that's important for the whole vision, to help in the differentiation between myself and this world. But now, just say, no matter what the model is of the world, doesn't really matter. The fact is that this world that we experience is mitya. That's what's important. You know, it doesn't matter what you say about it, or all of the complexity of it, the brilliance of it, the different layers, levels of reality. It's all mitya. Now, what does that mean? If you say something is mitya, first of all, mitya negates the experience of as having any absolute reality. If something is called mitya, you've negated that it has absolute reality. What does that mean? What we mean by paramarthika satyam, something that actually exists in and of itself, is not a borrowed existence, but has being itself, We say that something that actually is can never be negated in past, present, or future. Because if the thing actually exists, we can never, just using the language in a simple, not tricky form, if something which actually exists has a condition of prior non-existence, then that thing itself has no existence. It has to depend on something else for its existence. And the reason that is that we are serious when we use the word non-existence. Non-existence means for us, it is not there. Non-existence means it has no existence. And so something that is not cannot come into being, because there's nothing there to come into being. And yet we experience things coming into being all the time. Right? That's the whole nature of the creation. Things are coming into being, they're in flux, they're in continual motion, continual change. That means that they have had a prior condition which is now not there, right? And there's a new condition, and then a new condition, and then a new condition. So now, the new condition has to come from somewhere. It's not coming from non-existence. And so that new condition has to be dependent on something else that allows it to come into being. So it has to come into being from something that has been, right? Not something that has non-being. So that means it depends on something that has been for it to be. Otherwise, it can't come into being. But if it depends upon something else for it to be able to come into being, it's mitya. Mitya means that its being is dependent upon something else. That's the definition of mitya. The simplest definition of mitya is that it's not satyam, right? It doesn't exist in all three periods of time, and that it's not tucham, means it's not non-existent. So it's in this middle ground. We experience it, the experience is there, but the being that thing has is not its own. It depends upon that being. So it comes from that being, it goes into that being, right? It has a dependent being. That's what we mean by mitya. And so in our experience of the world, these names and forms can go into an infinite regress. This being... This object depends upon this, the being of this object depends upon the being of this object, which depends upon the being of this object. That can go into an infinite regress, which means there was never any creation of these objects. That's what happens. Once you get into infinite regress, that means that the nama rupa, whatever the form that is dependent on it, right, goes infinitely into an infinite regress. That means there is no creation for it. So creation is negated then, which we accept that completely, that there really is no creation, as though there's something that is creation, that is created, that has being. We don't accept that at all. We accept that there is one being, and everything that we experience resolves into that one being, has that one being for its truth. Those things themselves that go into infinite regress, that are infinitely dependent on something, some other being, have no creation at all, because it's infinite. Right? You can never get there in terms of nama-rupa. It's just like the same type of thing, like, say, if you take anything that... any object that you call an object is actually just a conglomerate of smaller objects. That also goes into an infinite regress. As long as it takes up space, it can be divided. You know, there's no end to it, right? But no matter how big it is or how small it is, it still is. Right? It comes and goes. These things all come and go, but the being doesn't come and go. The being is Brahman, right? And the same, we have the same situation in terms of the creation, in terms of time. Time is infinitely divisible. It's an infinite regress. As long as time, you know, has length of any sort, It's not an infinite point. If it has length of any sort, it's divisible. So time itself has to resolve only in presence, that which is free of time, because time is infinitely divisible, and so it doesn't exist really. It always takes place in the present. You can never get to the smallest moment of time, because if it's a moment, it's divisible. You see what I mean? So these type of things, understandings, negate negate the paramarthika satyam, the absolute reality of the creation, and that only means that this is an infinite, an expression of, as Swamiji will say, it's an expression of infinite knowledge, you know, whose being is me, is the self, whose truth is the self. That's the satyam mitya. The self is the adhishtana. Adhishtana is what in the end, mitya, whether you go into infinite regress or not, the being which the infinite regress in the search for being depends upon. You see what I mean? Yeah, it's really neat. It is. Hi, Virginia. Just saw you came in. Hi, Chuck. Jackie says, and David says, yet our previous lifetimes past karma seem to be characterized as or like an infinite regress in Vedanta. Yes, it's true. There's no first past life. It's an infinite regress. That's a little hard to wrap your head around, but that's what it is. There's no first life for the jiva, because there's no first creation. Another way to look at that, which is another mind-boggler. Just boggled my mind and I forgot what I was going to say. Just a minute. Let me think, because it's interesting. Oh, yeah. Also interesting is because the creation is infinite number of jivas, when you think about moksha, somehow this is related. Infinite number of jivas, infinite minus one is infinite, you know. It is an infinite regress, yeah. You are not a jiva. There is no jiva, really. You're Brahma, you're the self. And for you, there is no reincarnation at all. There's no time. Hi, Rob. Just saw your note. Anyway, these satsangs are kind of like the Mandukya Upanishad. We might as well be teaching it. It is, you know. This is all what Mandukya Upanishad. Mm-hmm. This one was what? Like the Mandukya? Oh, really good. Yeah, this is really good. This subject is taking it as far as it can go. Just about. Anybody else? Jackie and David say, in the contemplation, we are putting our attention on our own presence. And that own presence, we're doing that from the standpoint of the mind, right? So if I'm asking your mind to just gently, I always say a gentle change of focus. And why I say that is that there's no need to try to cut out other experiences. Like if I say, focus firmly on yourself as though you're not supposed to have any other experiences. The other experiences don't matter. All you need to do is have the mind focus on this, on yourself. So that is the bringing about discrimination on viveka on the part of the mind. And then I make a shift and say, just be yourself. So then the question is, then Jackie or David say, could this be said to be being aware of awareness? You can say that. It's a little tricky language, but that's kind of the experience where the mind is as though being aware of awareness. But if you analyze that experience, there is no one there aware of awareness. So that's actually, you can use that language, and then it's really useful to see what is happening when you are being aware of awareness. And what that actually is that, well, first of all, in that act of the mind is objectifying itself, okay? The mind becomes objectified and differentiated from awareness. That's what's actually happening. And awareness is aware of itself, not because there's a subject-object different relationship there, but because awareness is self-evident, self-shining. And so, yes, it is just awareness. That's right. It's just awareness. She says, or maybe it's just awareness. Then yes, it is just awareness. That's the nature of awareness. And what's neat about that is, you know, when from the mind standpoint, you say to turn your focus, to have a gentle focus on yourself, that actually just on the mind's part brings about that differentiation of the mind from the self. And then you can do the meditation where you notice that the mind is known. This is a little bit different, but it's talking in a way, it's pointing out the same thing a little differently. Notice that you're aware of the mind. Change that language. Then we say, the mind, the thought is known. Okay, the thought is known. Then you can say, the thought is known. The self is known, right? There is no thought that is known different from the knownness of the self. And the knownness of the self is the self-evident nature of awareness itself. So when you say, or maybe it's just awareness then, yes, it's just awareness. And awareness is the experience of known in language. When we say it is known, that is the self-evident nature of awareness. So if you got rid of the whole universe and just awareness is there, that it is known experience is there as the very swarupa, the very nature of awareness. And so then when you have a thought modification of some sort, you know, when you say that thought modification is known, the is-knownness doesn't belong to the thought modification. The is-knownness belongs to the awareness, which is the adhishtana, the very being that the thought modification being mitya enjoys. So that thought modification enjoys being known because it is mitya and its being is awareness. Isn't that neat? It is. I love it. Do you see what I mean by that? Yeah. Good. That's one of the things I love, that particular understanding. So everybody knows that on Thursday, I'll be at the farm and we'll have the Katha Upanishad online, and for those of us who are at the farm, we'll have the Katha here, so we'll have it online. And Saturday, Hopefully some of you are coming up to the farm. That would be wonderful if you can come. You have to be able to camp because there's just not enough rooms up here. But the weather will be good. It's beautiful. All of the trees and things are flowering. It's just amazing. So pretty here now. And I think the weather will be really, really nice. But I would check the weather before you come or give me a call at the farm. But bring a tent. See if you can come. It'll be really nice. It'd be really nice for me anyway. It'd be really nice to have you here. I think you'll enjoy it too. It's just nice to be away from the city. Okay, everybody, should we call it a night? We'll say our prayer. Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Maheshaha Go Brahmane Bhyashubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Pavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Kshobarahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, om purnamadav purnamidam purnat, Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om Om Tat Sat. Okay, everybody. Good night. I'm gonna go out the door.